I ask you a question as we start out today. How would you like to be a prophet? Not just talking about any prophet. I'm not talking about like Muhammad. I'm talking about one of the prophets in the Old Testament scriptures. I think a lot of us read our Old Testaments and we think, man, wouldn't it be so neat to be back in those times and to visually see with our own eyes the miraculous things that the prophets were doing in the name of the Lord? Wouldn't that be neat? And if you take that a step further, wouldn't it be neat to be one of the people that God is pouring His power through and parting the Red Sea and bringing fire down from heaven, doing all the things that the prophets did? Wouldn't it be cool to step into those shoes and be one of those guys? Think about this. How would you like to be Moses? Wouldn't that be neat? When you think about the prophets of the Bible, I mean, Moses is one of the guys that floats to the head of the list, doesn't he? Well, think about the pros of what it would be like to be like Moses, to be him. Well, for one thing, you're going to be adopted into Pharaoh's family. So, as all of the baby boys, the Israelite children, are being taken by Egyptian soldiers and thrust into the Red Sea, you're going to be put into a basket on, or sorry, not the Red Sea, the Nile River. Excuse me, I'm mixing my water stories here. Thrown into the Nile River, you're going to be put in a basket on the Nile River, and you're going to be floated downstream, but you're going to be picked up by the princess of Egypt. You know, the very daughter of the Pharaoh, you're going to grow up in that household, and you're going to have you're going to be living in a palace. You're going to have all the best food, all the best clothing, a first-class education, because Stephen says in Acts 7 that Moses was educated in all of the wisdom and understanding of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in word and deed. Unlike what Moses himself says, that I can't speak very well. Stephen said that's baloney. He couldn't speak really well. So you're going to have all of the benefits and the blessings of being an adopted prince of Egypt. Think about other things that you'll get to do. Extraordinary miracles are going to be done by your hands. Some of the most devastating plagues in world history are going to come upon Egypt because you are going to raise up your staff. A massive body of water is going to part because you're going to raise up your staff. So many things will happen along the way in the wilderness. Water is going to pour out of a rock where there was no water because you hit it with your staff. God is going to pour out His power through you in extremely impressive ways. Here's something else that would be great about being Moses. Is you're going to get to live to 120 years old. And not only that, you're going to do that with full strength intact. So you're not going to be a man who is just shriveled up, hobbling on crutches at 120. You're going to have the body of a 20-year-old your entire life. Your sight will go undimmed. You're not going to have organ failure. You're not going to have cancer. You're not going to have all of the diseases and the things that naturally happen to our physical bodies through the course of our lives. This is going to happen to you. That'd be pretty nice to enjoy all those things, wouldn't it? Well, what are the cons of being Moses? Let's think about that before we want to step into his shoes. Something that's going to happen to you, and it's going to be really difficult for you, is that you're going to be rejected by your own people. And then you're going to spend the next four decades after that watching sheep in the wilderness. So what's going to happen is at 40 years old, you're going to leave your palace, and you're going to walk amongst your people, and you're going to see an Egyptian beating one of your own people. You're going to kill that Egyptian and try to help that, and you're going to expect that your people just understand that with your power and influence, being an Israelite, you're going to be the one to bring salvation to them. But they're not going to want that. In fact, the next day, one of them is going to get smart with you and say, well, who made you a judge over us? You're going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian yesterday? They're not going to want you. And when the Egyptians find out about what you did to one of them, then you're really going to have to run away from your entire life that you were born into, to the land of Midian, to a wilderness, and you're going to settle down. It's going to be good. You're going to get married, and you're going to have some kids, but you're going to become a shepherd. You're going to be down here on the totem pole instead of where you were at the top, at the beginning of your life. And you'll think that that's about it. So that's going to be hard in a lot of ways. But then what comes afterwards is going to be even harder. Because God is going to show up when you're 80 years old. And he's going to say, actually, you watching sheep in the wilderness was not my plan for the rest of your life. You get a new job. And it's not a job that you're going to want to have. You're going to have the job of leading a nation of grumbling idolaters for the next 4 decades after the 4 decades you spent watching sheep in the wilderness. You ever know anybody, or have you ever been like this yourself, who just constantly looks at the negative, constantly grumbling and complaining about what you don't have as opposed to what you do? Now imagine an entire nation of people like that. You get to lead them. You get to take them out. You get to take care of them. You get to break up all the fights. You get to resolve all the disputes. Eventually, just the most serious ones are going to come to you. But you're going to be in those people's lives. And it doesn't matter how much you do for them. It doesn't matter how many oases you lead them to. It doesn't matter how, you know, the law that you go up on the mountain to bring down to them. It doesn't matter how much you try to point them to God. They're never going to love God as a nation. Some of them will individually. But for the most part, you're leading a people who are all going to die in the wilderness, despite all your work. That's going to be hard in a lot of ways. Because something else is going to happen when you're out there in those 4 decades is you're going to deal with not just one, not just two, not even just three. You're going to deal with several really serious rebellions in which people turn against you and they turn against more seriously the God that gave you the job of leading them. Because at one point, your own brother and sister are going to take you aside and say, you know, we're prophets too. What makes you think that you can be above us? Now, why are you marrying that Ethiopian woman like you just did? That's inappropriate. Shouldn't be doing that. At one point in time, there's also going to be this guy from your own tribe, Korah, who's going to decide that you've led people enough, and now he's going to take over. And God's going to take care of that situation, but that's going to be tense, and that's going to be hard and difficult in a lot of ways. And there will be other points in time that are hard too, like the 12 spies, when they get back from spying out the land of Egypt, they're going to come back to your people, and 10 of them are going to say, we can't go in there. It's a beautiful land, there's lots of green things, there's lots of crops, but the people there are too big. We can't do it. And the people are going to appoint a new leader to take your place and attempt to go back to Egypt. Because no matter where you go or what you're doing, they're always going to be talking about the great life that they had back there in slavery, as opposed to the life that they have now. That's going to be hard. In fact, this is going to be all so hard that at one point, you're going to want to throw in the towel. You're going to get so discouraged that you're actually going to ask God to kill you. And here's what you're going to say. This comes from Numbers 11, 14 through 15. I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness. And you're going to say that about the time that the people are so sick of eating manna that they're literally all crying at their tent doors because they can't stand their food any longer. And you're just going to say, I give up, God. Just kill me. So, how many of us would like to be Moses now? Probably not. Well, let's try another prophet. Now, that was Moses, but what about Elijah? You know, there's another extraordinary prophet from the Old Testament that we look up to. I mean, when Jesus was up on the mountain and when he was being transfigured, it was Moses and Elijah that were standing up there with him in his glory. So think about what he did. You're also going to be somebody who will perform extraordinary miracles. We talked about Mount Carmel in during the class in the parables this morning, how Elijah goes up to that place and all the prophets of Baal come and there's this huge showdown. You're going to build your altar, I'm going to build mine. We're going to call upon our gods and we're going to see which one is actually there. And so the prophets of Baal go first, and they dance around it, they cut themselves with lances, they do all kinds of crazy things, and yet Baal doesn't say a word and doesn't answer and doesn't do anything to the altar. But then you, if you're Elijah, you're going to construct an altar to the Lord, and you're going to douse it over and over with water. You're going to call upon him, and he's going to answer in a tremendously awesome kind of way. So that's going to be pretty impressive. Something else that's going to happen is one day soldiers from a later king are going to try to arrest you. He's going to send 50 soldiers to the hill that you're sitting on top of. And you're going to notice them down there. They're going to say, hey, you better come down here. And you're going to say, well, if I'm a man of God, like you're calling me, let fire come down from heaven and consume all of you. And it's going to happen. And then it's going to happen again when another 50 soldiers try to come to your hill and arrest you. You're going to have a thing with fire. So something else is going to happen is during a time of drought, time of famine, you're going to be staying with a woman, a widow, and her son's going to die. You are going to go into the room with her son's dead body. You're going to perform a resurrection through the power of God in you, unlike so many other prophets. They didn't do that, but you're going to do that. You're going to be so mighty that future prophets are actually going to be compared to you. Remember when John the Baptist is going to be born and his dad is being told about him to come? The angel says in Luke's gospel, John is going to come in the strength and power of Elijah. That's what he's going to do. When Jesus is asking his guys, who do people say that I am? What's one of the names that the disciples bring up? Well, some people say, you're Elijah, because you're that mighty and you're that powerful and you're doing such things that Elijah did. Something else about you, if you're Elijah, is you're not going to die. And you're going to enter heaven in this chariot of fire. Now, none of us want to die, right? Well, you're going to escape that if you are this prophet. And you're going to leave the earth in this tremendously dramatic way. You remember how the next prophet, Elisha, he's asking for a double portion of Elijah's spirit when Elijah said, hey, what can I do for you before I leave? Well, you can give me that. Well, Elijah said, that's pretty hard to do. So, but here's the deal. If you see me go, then you'll have a double portion of my spirit. And boy, did he see him go. Because these fire horses pulling fire chariots come down, swoop him up, and he goes up into a whirlwind into the heavens. That's incredible if you're Elijah. There's a lot of pros to that. But if you're Elijah, what are the cons? How would you like to be the person who experiences this? That the greatest moment of your life does not produce the change that you thought it would. At Mount Carmel, when all the people see the fire and what happens with that, they all freely admit, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. And you expect that they're going to act upon the fact that they're acknowledging that, but they don't do anything about that. Ahab and Jezebel are still on the throne the next day. Nothing happens with Baal worship, despite the fact that everybody saw that Baal is nothing compared to Yahweh, the true God. So you're going to get pretty discouraged about that. The leadership of the land is not going to support you at all. They're going to hate you. In fact, they're going to want you dead. Not only does Jezebel and Ahab not get overthrown right after that tremendously powerful example of God's power, Jezebel is going to send you a message and say, basically, if you're not gone by tomorrow, you're going to be like those prophets of Baal that you just killed. And so you are going to have to run, very much like Moses did. And you're not going to get support. You're going to feel pretty useless and pretty alone. You're going to isolate yourself. You have a servant, but you're going to tell your servant to stay behind as you run all the way down to the mountain of God. Everybody is going to be away from you. And when God approaches you and asks why you're there, you're going to tell him it's because I'm the only one left. I can't do anything else. All of your people have rejected you. They've torn down your altars. I alone am left, and they're seeking my life to take it away. And so just like Moses, you're going to ask God to take your life. Here's what you're going to say. 1 Kings 19, verse 4. It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. So, how many of us would like to be Elijah? Well, maybe not. It'd be pretty hard. Well, let's just take another prophet that maybe we don't know as much about. Let's just say Ezekiel, for example. What are the pros of being Ezekiel? Well, for one thing, you're going to win the genetic lottery because you're going to be born into not just the Levites, the tribe of special servants to God. You're going to be born into the family of Aaron, the family that became the priests, the ones that had the special, incredible job of going into the holy places of God and mediating for the people and offering sacrifices and the people who were tasked with learning the law and teaching it to the people. That's going to be your job. But that's not going to happen. We'll talk about that in a second. Something else that's really neat about Ezekiel, if you're him, is that you get to see fantastic visions of God. If you go to Ezekiel 1 and you read that, you're going to see that he experienced things that so many other prophets didn't see. Basically, you're going to see the Godmobile. We talk about Batman and the Batmobile. In Ezekiel 1, you've got this throne on top of these incredible wheels. And the wheels can turn anywhere they want to. And the wheels have eyes all around them. And these living creatures are up there kind of supporting this massive throne that God himself is sitting on. You're going to be able to see an appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. It's not going to be God's full glory. It's going to be a watered-down version, but it's going to be enough to blow your mind. And you get to talk about that with the people that you're with. So you're going to see things like that. There will be other things in that book like that, too. That's going to be an example, though. But what about the cons of being Ezekiel? One of the things that's going to happen to you is you're going to be carried into exile. And the people that you're tasked to preach to, they're going to be people that are just not going to listen. They're going to think you're entertaining. They're going to enjoy coming to hear your sermons. But they're not. They're going to listen to you like somebody would listen to a concert, not as somebody who's listening to open up their hearts in order to change their behavior and their thinking. And so it's going to be hard to leave your land. Because at 30 years old, chapter 1 of Ezekiel says in the 30th year, right about the time that you are going to take the job of the priest and start carrying your priestly responsibilities, you're going to be taken away from the temple. And you're not going to have an opportunity to fulfill the job that you've been preparing your entire life to do. You're going to have a different job now. You're going to be a priest, but you're going to be a different kind of priest. You're going to be a mediator between God and the people with the words that he puts into your mouth to say, in addition to the law of Moses that you've been training to teach. And God's going to tell you, you know what? They're just not going to listen. They're a rebellious house. But you know what? I want you to be there, and I want you to still speak so that they will know that a prophet has been among them. And that will make it worth it, as long as you're doing that. That's going to be hard for you. Something else is going to be hard, and this is just one example of many things that are hard about being you. If you're Ezekiel, you're going to, as a sign to the people, you're going to lay on your sides for over a year, and then you're going to eat food during that period that's cooked over dung. It's really interesting how in the first part of the book, Ezekiel's going to be told, I want you to build a toy model of Jerusalem. I want you to build siege ramps and siege engines, and I want you to besiege it in a way, get your little toy soldiers out and just kind of act that out. And then while you're doing that, you're going to be laying on your left side for 390 days. And then you're going to flip over, and you're going to lay on your right side for 40 days. You're going to bear the punishment that I'm going to inflict on the people. You're going to act that out for them. And you're going to lay on your side with your arm bared against that little toy city and preach against it and say, God's going to come. God's going to destroy it. You're going to look ridiculous, and it's not going to be that comfortable. And the food that you're going to eat is this weird concoction of basically famine material that you're going to kind of smush together into a bread and cook it over human dung. And at that point, you're going to say, God, I can't do human dung. Please don't make me do that. And then God's going to say, okay, it doesn't have to be human, but we'll go with cow.
Terrible.
All right? That's your life, though, if you're Ezekiel. Something else is going to be so hard, though. This is probably the hardest for me. Is your beloved spouse, on very short notice, is going to be taken away from you. And you're not even going to be allowed to mourn her departure. One day God's gonna give you a message. And he's going to say, you know, Ezekiel, that wife that you love so much, today she's going to die. Today. And I want you to act as though nothing has happened. You're not going to put on mourning clothes. You're going to cry, but you're not going to do it aloud. And you're just going to keep going on with your life. And so that happens. Ezekiel spoke to the people in the morning, and the text says, at evening, his wife died. And the people were shocked at what happened to him and his reaction to it. What does that mean, Ezekiel? And Ezekiel is tasked by God to say, it means that when Jerusalem finally falls, you know, we're all sitting in exile in Babylon, when Jerusalem falls, you're going to act as though nothing has happened. You're just going to keep going on with your life. And that's what I'm doing to show you what that's going to be like. So how many of us would like to be Ezekiel? That would be pretty hard, wouldn't it? Well, aren't we so glad that we're not prophets? Aren't we so glad that God does not expect us to have the level of difficulty that these guys did? That the level of our commitment to the Lord doesn't have to be as high as it was for them? Aren't we so thankful that all we've got to do is just kind of maintain this loose connection to the Lord and to each other? Obviously, I'm being facetious. But isn't this the way some of us think? Aren't we so glad that we can just be Christian in name, kind of wear that as a badge, kind of go through some motions on some things that we do here, and then kind of just live our own lives the rest of the week? Now, here's what Jesus says about this. That we are, Christians are the successors to the Old Testament prophets. Do you see what he says in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 11 and 12? Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. It almost sounds like Jesus is drawing a pretty strong connection between the life that they lived and the life that we live as Christians. It sounds like the kind of high commitment they were supposed to have to God is the same kind of commitment He wants us to have as well. And it sounds like following Jesus necessarily implies suffering and discomfort and dealing with people and situations that are not always fun for us. Because notice what he says here. It's not if you're persecuted, it's when. That's the language. Here's something else. And this is coming from the book of James. James chapter 5 in verse 10. James says this as an example, and James talks about suffering the entire book of James. And toward the end, he kind of draws it together and he says this, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. If we're supposed to take them, does that mean that then our lives are going to kind of look like them? That we're gonna experience the same kinds of things that they did. I think it's interesting that this verse talks about patience. If you look at the context of James 5 and the rest of the book, there's going to be a discussion of patience a lot in this letter, kind of looking forward to when Jesus comes back and when we obtain the reward that he's talking about, you know, that Jesus was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. So our lives are going to be challenging. There's no doubt about that, and it's clearly said, but it's only for a short time, like it was for the prophets. They received their reward, and we will as well, if we follow their footsteps and do the kinds of things that they did before glory comes. Well, here's another thought, and I want to end with this question. How would you like to be Jesus? And I think it's obvious when we talk about Jesus, he was a prophet, but he was more than an Elijah. He was more than a Jeremiah, which is something that people did not understand, but his guys understood eventually. He's the prophet of prophets. He's the Son of God. How would you like to be the Son of God? You know, the pros would be pretty nice. I mean, you get to be the creator of the heavens and the earth, the shaper of everything that we have in our universe. You're going to have all power. There's going to be nothing that you won't understand, nothing that you won't see. You have all joy in understanding perfectly what peace feels like and what love and joy feel like. But you know what the challenges are going to be? The weight of the transgressions of mankind are going to rest on your shoulders. Because that's what Isaiah 53, remember, talks about. The crushing horrors of all that we have done are going to fall upon you. And you're going to go to a human cross to take those sorrows and that pain with you. Well, aren't we thankful that we don't have a cross in our life, like Jesus did? Aren't we thankful that we just don't have to bear that kind of weight that he did? Well, we don't in that kind of way. But you know what Jesus did say about our cross? We do have one. And we have one every day if we're following him. Because that's what he said in Luke chapter 9, 23 and 24. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. When we take the Lord's Supper together, as we are about to do, we are not just remembering what he did and giving up his body and his blood for our sins and the sins of the world. We're remembering the kind of sacrifice that we need to give. And if it takes our body and if it takes our blood to follow Jesus, that is exactly what we will be called upon to do for him. The level of our commitment is challenged when we partake of this supper in the right kind of way. Because what does it mean to take up your cross every day? It means you love your brethren. Maybe even on days where you don't feel like loving your brethren. You serve them, you pray for them, you help them however you can. You love your family members, whoever they might be. And I know some of your family members are not easy. but you love them and you serve them and you help them and you care for them however you can, regardless of what comes back to you or not. And you love the non-Christians in your life out there, the neighbors that you know, the people that you work with, the people that you meet on the street. They have souls just like we do. And regardless of the kind of reaction that we get when we talk to them about Jesus, we need to be telling them about Him, because He's changed our lives. He's taken up His cross. We need to take up ours. But you know what the interesting thing about this is? When Jesus actually did go to the cross, and He did pick it up in order to go to Golgotha, how far did He get? It wasn't very far until it became too heavy for Him to bear, and somebody else had to come alongside of Jesus and pick it up and carry it. I believe that's a picture of what God does with us. You might look at verses like this and just think, there's no way I can do that. That's too much for me to bear. Does that sound familiar? Moses, Elijah, it's too much, Lord. That expectation is crushing me, and I wish You'd just kill me now. I can't handle it. God comes alongside of Moses and Elijah, helps them out. And then they keep going. Somebody comes alongside of Jesus to help Him carry His cross. That is what our God does with you and me. He gives us this expectation, but He comes alongside of us as we try to take this up every day, and He helps us carry it. He is commanding us to bear a burden that only He can carry fully. So we need to sign up for the crushing weight of the job of a prophet. Because that's what God's people do. We preach, we proclaim, we have terrible things happen to us in expectation that we're going to get an incredible reward at the end of days that goes far beyond the small little suffering that we have here. And that was the trajectory of Jesus Christ Himself. How hard was it to be the teacher that He was? To preach over and over to stubborn, hard-hearted people who just refused to open up their ears and their hearts. But where is He now? He's at the right hand of God. And He's promised us that we're going to be there too if we follow the steps of the prophets and if we follow the steps of Jesus. Let's let Him carry us through that job until the day when He makes us whole.